Yeah, you know, the rack, that's something that we talk about a lot in our program. And, you know, you said it right there, relationships, accountability, competitiveness. That's really what I'm rooted in. That's what our program's rooted in. You know, everything pretty much flows from those three buckets. You know what I mean? But that relationships, you know, element, that's first for a reason. You know, before anything, at the end all be all, it's relationships. You know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is get a group of people to be aligned. And the best way to do that is to make sure you bring in great people and you cultivate an environment where great people can thrive.
Welcome back to another episode of Not Even D2. I'm your host, KJ Allison, here with my boy and co-host, Neruda Perdomo. Fire episode today. Usually I'd be asking you, like, how you, bro? But I already know how you feeling. Knicks 1-0. They got a tough win against the Celtics. So I'm going to just give you the platform and talk your shit. I know you was beefing with some Celtics people online. So just go.
Yeah, bro. First of all, it's good to see you, my boy. Good to get back on for another episode, another good intro. But yeah, definitely happy about the Knicks winning. You know, Knicks in 6. Don't overthink it. Feel me? Now it's Knicks in 7. But yeah, definitely feeling good, bro. It's a great time to be a Knicks fan. You know what I'm saying? Like, Brunson's the man, yo. Brunson's the man.
E-O-D.
He's O-D.
You've been saying, like, clutch player of the year. Yo, fourth quarter, Brunson could be playing 0-for-20 the whole game. And then as soon as fourth quarter hit, he's not going to miss.
Bro, so it makes me think back to when I was growing up, when I was, like, living in New Hampshire, right? Isaiah Thomas, who played for the Celtics, like he had that run where he was averaging like 29 a game, but he was like king of the fourth quarter, where like you knew like if the game was close, he could take over. So like it kind of reminds me a little bit, you know, nostalgic vibes. But yeah, Brunson is definitely killing, bro. It's great to see. I feel like I said, like I've been telling everyone over text, like if the game is close with any team in the NBA and they're playing the Knicks, like I like our chances, bro. We're really good in the clutch, bro. We execute in the clutch. And part of that has to do with the chemistry too. Like guys just know how to play with each other, but also too, like OG Anunoby's been killing, right?
I was like, having a convo about him this morning, bro.
He looked like the best. He looked like maybe you can make an argument for like the best player on the floor in game one. You know what I'm saying? Just with his stat line, the way he was playing, the way like 10 for 20, 29 points, like he was guarding JT. You know what I'm saying? Cat definitely got to pick it up, but I was definitely happy, you know, the last couple of games from the Knicks, bro. How you feeling about the Thunder though? For real.
Real quick about OG, like someone asked me, "Yo, do you think OG is like he's legit or is this a fluke run?" And I was like, "Yo, this is like a large sample size of OG, like he's shooting the piss out of it. He's physical, getting downhill, he be punching on people and like you mentioned like he can guard big wings like Cade. Now he's got JT, so we got to start talking about OG a little bit more than we have been in the past. But the Knicks definitely looking good, bro. I'm going to give my predictions about that series in a little bit. But to talk about the Thunder, like last night, when Aaron Gordon hit that shot, bro, phone started going crazy. I just shut my shit off. I didn't talk to nobody the rest of the day, bro. I was tight. I woke up this morning like, nah, bro, it's not even that big of a deal, bro. Like, it was up 16, was dominating the game. They went on a run, that happens. I expect them to get one home game win, so we just got one game two. But, fucking, it definitely hurt yesterday, bro. Like, I'm not even on the team, but it definitely, like, little gut punch when that shot went in. What you think about the game real quick? We don't want to talk too much NBA, but what you think?
Bro, let me keep it a buck with you. I only watched the first half. You know, I had to – you know, I dipped from Hagen's crib after the first half. But I mean, I watched some of the highlights. It looked super competitive. Jokic was dominating, but you know, I seen the last sequence, you know, that decision to foul Chet. Really interesting coaching decision by Adelman. And like he gotta finish that play. But he looked like, bro, you could tell it like on his like his body language, he was like right before he's about to shoot that free throw. So I was like,
bro, they fouled him the person I'm watching with, I'm like, oh yeah, Chet don't miss free throws. 0-2, bro. 0-2. I was dead ass tight, bro.
Yeah, you gotta come away with one.
The one thing I was scared about this, like going into the playoffs for the Thunder, was Dub and Chet not looking like themselves, bro. Because the same thing happened last year in the playoffs. When it got real, that they kind of like froze up, and I'm seeing the same thing from yesterday's game. So I'm hoping that changes. I think that it's gonna change, but if they're not playing like all star caliber players, then we got no chance. But real quick, so if you've been watching the show, I lost the predictions last week. I did my 40 push-ups. We put a little bet on it. 40 push-ups done. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see it. But let's talk about these series. We're just going to give our predictions. We're not going to give any breakdown or nothing. We're going to go series by series. We'll start with the Timberwolves versus Warriors. We haven't seen any of those games. We're recording on a Tuesday. So who you got?
I got Warriors in seven.
I got Warriors in seven. Okay. I got the T-Wolves in six. I was going to say five, but I got the T-Wolves in six. It's tough to get Curry out of there in five, but I got the T-Wolves for sure. Next series, Cavs, Pacers. We already seen game one. Pacers up 1-0 right now. So what you thinking?
Damn, I got
the Cavs. This is a caveat. If DG's playing, I got the Cavs in six. But if DG's not playing, I got the Pacers in seven. So
okay,
those are my picks.
You can't be – yeah, got to pick one. Game us up, bro.
I'm going to pick. I got Cavs in seven then. I'll go in the middle. Cavs in seven.
All right, bet. I'm going to say Cavs in seven too.
Okay. All right, bet. Yeah. We'll do my the Thunder Nuggets. I want to hear yours first before I say mine.
I got Thunder in seven. I got Thunder in seven.
I still got the Thunder in six. I said that before the series started. And I'm still gonna be strong on that. Thunder in six, we good. But I'll say mine for the Knicks. I got the season seven, and I was gonna say Knicks coming into here, but I got the season seven.
I respect it, bro. I got the Knicks in seven. You know, I got to root the home team, man.
All right, but so we'll keep that going. We doing 40 again?
40.
I'm not doing another 40. So
all right, let's, 25.
Let's
lock 25.
In, team. Let's get this done. But let's talk about today's episode, bro. We got a really good episode. One that we've been really like trying to get, not to be like this, but like a black head coach, because there's not that many in Division III. So this one was big, and we got Coach Brandon Linton, who's currently the head coach at Tufts University. A really good school, leading a really good program. And how we got connected, I'm actually doing a project for school about like this lack of diversity issue in Division III. And he was more than willing to get on, but we decided like basically your story or your program is too important to just do it for that. Like, let's just do a regular episode with you. And it was a really good conversation, you know, talking about his career. So just talk to me about what you thought about this episode and talking with Coach Lynn.
Well, first thing I want to say, bro, I know you had mentioned to me the project that you did talking about diversity of coaches in Division III, but, you know, like, I didn't know when you were going to, like, film it or anything like that. So one day, you know, I seen some of the interviews in StreamYard, dude, and they were great listens, bro. So definitely proud of you and the project that you finished. I'm you better get an A or I'm going to be tight.
Appreciate that.
Of course, brother, of course. But, yeah, so great conversation with Coach, you know, Coach Lynn. You know, Tufts, like you mentioned, is one of the best schools in the country, right? Like, they've done a lot of winning while he's been there, right? He's a great coach. He's been to Nichols. He's been to Tufts. You know, he's at Army West Point. So he's been around. He's at Bowdoin, right? But he's a really good basketball mind. And we had a great conversation with him. And like I always say, I'm really excited for the viewers to get to know him and just hear the voice behind Tufts basketball, because, you know, it's like you said, it's an historic program, great school, you know, great just overall athletic program in general too, with Tufts, you know, being in contention for like the Champions Cup or whatever it is in Division III every year. But definitely a great conversation.
Word. I feel like Tufts kind of gets lost in the NESCAC, but it shouldn't, specifically their basketball program, because like this is three straight seasons of 20 plus wins, three straight seasons of making the NCAA tournament. There's not many programs that can say the same thing, but it kind of gets lost in the NESCAC because Like, for example, this past year, William or Wesleyan and Trinity getting all the attention. The year before that, Williams and Trinity getting all the attention. They're ranked really high nationally. So Tufts and Coach Linton, they're not really getting that spotlight because they're like third or fourth in the NESCAC. But this is a special program. And I think why it's so good is, like, he's not just preaching philosophy. Like, he's practicing it. You talked about, like, this growth mindset, and it's 100%. You can see it. Like, year by year, they just continuously get better statistically and, like, just by record. So it's important that a coach isn't just, like, preaching what he wants his players to do, but he's practicing it because it just trickles down to everybody else throughout the program.
100%. I mean, we see that. You gotta, if you're whoever's at the top, gotta, you know, carry that same mindset and those same habits, because that he or she's only gonna influence the, you know, players around them, people around them. But, like, you're right. I mean, you know, 54-26 and his time at, you know, Tufts, you know, reading the website, that's crazy. That's a great accomplishment. And, you know, like you said, they're doing a lot of winning, bro. And I think they're gonna be in for a good year. You know, NESCAC's gonna look pretty interesting next year. You know, I know, I'm pretty sure, like, Trent got some guys in the portal right now, so I don't really know what's up with them. I mean, obviously, they're coming off a natty, so they're going to be good if they return those guys. But Tufts is returning a lot of great players and bringing in some good incoming freshmen. You know that Wesley and Coach Riley's going to be back, Williams, all that stuff. So NESCAC definitely going to be a battle next year, bro.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's always a battle in the NESCAC. Like, that's probably the best or second best league in the country. And, like, same thing, like, You see the NESCAC teams, they're all competitive and they're all pushing each other because you don't want to get left at the bottom. So you got to go hard in recruiting. You got to go hard in your game plans and all that. But one conversation I wanted to bring up, circling back on, like, a Black head coach. And this was special to me just because, like, as a minority, you don't really see people, especially in this division, and positions of power. So I just want to give one last shout out to Coach Linton for, like, you know, having this platform as a Black head coach at one of the best schools in the country. Like, Tufts is a really, really good school. The location is awesome, etc. But it's special, like, for aspiring coaches, minorities like us, to see coaches like Coach Linton have this platform. And he's doing, like, he didn't get his position not looking out for others, like, around him. Like, it's still, you guys were talking about, like, inclusivity. Like, he's big on that. And it's tough at a PWI, but shout out to Coach Lane. He's doing a really good job. And
No, 100%, bro. I love what you said just about, you know, seeing ourselves in coaches, right? Like, that's the biggest thing, seeing the inspiration. And you want to, you know, the fact that Coach Linton is, like, pushing for diversity, like you said, at a PWI, like, you love seeing stuff like that, you know what I mean? And he's only going to inspire and influence more, you know, minority coaches to get out there, bro. So, you know, the world is ours, so it's going to be good.
I like that. That's a good way to end the intro. So let's hear from our guy, Coach Linton. All right, we are here with Coach Linton. How you doing today, Coach?
I'm doing great, KJ. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, we appreciate you getting on, Coach. It's gonna be a great episode. But just kind of walk me through your day. How's your day been today? How's the offseason going for you?
Yeah. Everything's going good, man. We're, it's a little different at the D3 level, as you guys know. Like, you get to the offseason and, less on the basketball on-court stuff and kind of more on the, you know, administrative, recruiting, all that. But it's been good, man. Got a little workout in today. Now here with you guys.
Yeah. You was telling us you got a few little babies. You got anything special planned with them this summer, or they're too young for that?
No, a little light travel. Yes, I got the 2.5-year-old, 11-month-old. Honestly, the summer's going to be, you know, just bringing them to Tufts and letting them run around in the gym and get energy out. But we'll do, we go down to Cape Cod. We got my wife's family down there. We'll go down to Charlotte to see my family. And then other than that, just little day trips, probably. It's hard. You guys don't know it yet, man, but it's hard bringing them little two and unders anywhere. So you got to keep it short and sweet.
No, I feel that.
Coach, I had a quick question for you. So when we were texting you, I saw that you had a 917 number, and I got a 212 number. So So New York City. So I'm wondering, can you kind of tell us about your background a little bit? I got to hear.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Yeah. 917 Queens. So I'm a Queens kid. So.
Okay.
It's funny. Now I've been in the Northeast and Boston and in Maine and all this stuff too long, man. But yeah, I was born and raised in north side of Queens. So East Elmhurst, like right by LaGuardia Airport. It used to be, you know, that used to become with a lot of jokes to say, you know, you live by LaGuardia, but now LaGuardia is like the best airport in the world, man. But yeah, that's where I grew up. You know, my parents were there up until last year when they decided to retire down south.
So are you a Mets fan? Because Mets are right in Queens.
I'm heavy in the Mets, Knicks, and Jets. So the Jets,
that's a bad mix.
Whoa. Everything else used to be a real bad mix. Now it's like a decent mix. The Jets don't get to fill it up.
Since we're talking a little about your background, I heard you talking in an interview about how your parents were Jamaican immigrants, if I'm correct.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
So just talk a little about that, because you made a joke how like you guys think you're the best at everything. So just talk about growing up with Jamaican parents, stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, man. Good question. Yeah, my parents came to the country in the early 80s, and you know, they had family up here, and you know, just created a you know, what they felt would be a better life for me and my sister to come up in. You know, obviously they didn't know that when they came here. They had us when they got out here. But you know, it's one of the best things, as I reflect on my life, man, is you know, having the parents that I did and having the culture that I did as a Jamaican, the son of Jamaican parents. They just instill so many of, you know, those you know, what I realize now is great qualities. Hard work, being humble, you know, just putting your head down and getting after it. You know, just you know, they raised my sister to such a high standard and high expectations because of, you know, what they had to go through to set this all up for us. So we, you know, we always had this appreciation and gratitude for the things that we got. You know, we didn't have a lot that we would come up with, but we always had enough. We never had to feel like we had to need. So it was, you know, a great environment to grow up in. Tough at times, because if you know anything about Jamaican parents, they're not letting you do much of anything. Like I said, that discipline, you know, probably comes from them. But it's yeah, no, it's cool, man. It's a special thing, especially as you get older, to feel like you got some culture and some diversity in what your family's been able to do. So it's fun, man. I appreciate that question.
Yeah, no, 100%. Rudy, I didn't mean to cut you off, but it's not to get too political, but it's kind of crazy. Like, I shouldn't stereotype, but if you talk to a lot of immigrants, like, they have that similar, like, gratitude and just appreciation. So it's kind of sad that, like, today we're this country is kind of hunting and trying to get them out, when those type of people are some of the best people you can meet. So I definitely find that really interesting. But I want to talk about the Tufts program a little bit. So your first year at Tufts, you guys won 13 games, I believe 13 and 10. And then since then, continuously improving the wins, 20 wins, 21, 22. And then this past year, you guys obviously had a really good run. So just talk about like what the offseason looks like for you and the staff to continuously see that growth, like year after year, you just getting more wins, especially in a tough league like the NESCAC.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, man. It's, you know, on one hand, you know, before talking about anything that we try and do, you know, Tufts is a great place, man. I think always, you know, Tufts is going to have an inherent advantage just because, you know, it's a phenomenal school. It's in a great location. So really our job is just kind of like make sure that we're, you know, having the right habits and, you know, getting the right people in the door, and then the rest should take care of itself. But, you know, one thing that we do that we've talked about from the beginning is just, you know, that concept of, you know, that 1%, you know, getting 1% better every day, you know, kind of trying to win the margins, if you will. You know, and I feel like, you know, now being 4 years into it, I feel like that's something that we've collectively been able to kind of grab onto. It's just that continual development theme. You know, I think it's shown. You know, we just continue to, you know, grow, you know, be real with where we're at, understand the development that needs to take place. Honestly, a lot of times that comes from having some unfortunate losses or not winning at the rate that you want to. A lot of times that adversity exposes, you know, what needs to be improved. So we've been, you know, fortunate to have that kind of mindset of continual growth, that 1% better. And, you know, I think that's why we've kind of had that upward trajectory. It also helps that we've, you know, brought in some guys that can really play year after year, that keep trying to push the limits to how good Tufts basketball could be. So I'm just a fortunate coach in that way that, yeah, we got some good players. So more wins usually come when you have really good players. So.
Coach, I'm kind of wondering when you developed this growth mindset. Like, was it early on in your career? Have you always had it, number one? And then number two, how do you, you said you're recruiting a lot of good players, but how do you get your players to take on that same mindset as you, that culture of, you know, 1% better every day?
And I want to add on to that a little bit more just for the viewers, like your philosophy, you're big on relationships, accountability, and competitiveness, right? So just talk about like that whole philosophy, adding on with the 1% better too. So on top of Rudy's questions, if you remember what he said.
yeah. You forcing me to see how smart I am, how much I can remember. I think it ties back a little bit to, you know, the question about my parents and upbringing, just my journey. I feel like I've always, it was funny when I got the job at Tufts, you know, one thing I talked about with the athletic director that was hiring me was, you know, that idea of imposter syndrome, you know what I mean? Like I always felt like, you know, am I that good? You know, can I do this? And I think, you know, we probably, whether we admit it or not, we probably all deal with that. But definitely for me, you know, I was never, you know, the D1 recruit. I was never the guy whose dad was a coach. I was never, you know, it never felt like, you know, this was a thing that I should be excelling at. Like there was no proof really for me to like say, hey, this is why I should be. So I think naturally, you know, I always kind of had that underdog mentality. I always had that, I don't know if it's a thirst or what to just get better and prove people wrong, prove myself right. But I feel like I've always kind of inherently had that thought process. So, you know, it was just natural for me to kind of try and pour that into my programs and the guys here. So that 1% element, I think it's just like a natural thing that just kind of flows from how I think, how I'm wired, how I've kind of gotten to this point. And you know, the rack, that's something that we talk about a lot in our program. And, you know, you said it right there, relationships, accountability, competitiveness. That's really what I'm rooted in. That's what our program's rooted in. You know, everything pretty much flows from those three buckets. You know what I mean? But that relationships, you know, element, that's first for a reason. You know, before anything, at the end all be all, it's relationships. You know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is get a group of people to be aligned. And the best way to do that is to make sure you bring in great people and you cultivate an environment where great people can thrive. So, you know, it's twofold, right? You got to develop it, but you also, you know, you got to attract that within your program. So, you know, that obviously ties into our recruiting and making sure that we're doing what we need to there. But relationships is a number one goal. You know, we had our team barbecue, end of the year barbecue yesterday. And, you know, that was one thing that we said, man, at the end of the day, we want to create the best, you know, family. And in the process, hopefully we get a bunch of wins doing so. But the relationships is number one. You know, that accountability piece almost goes hand in hand with relationships. You know, if you care about the people in your circle, you know, you're obviously going to be on top of what you're doing, right? Because if you're not on top of what you're doing, you're going to be holding each other back. Like you guys are on this podcast. If Ruta's not on his game, guess what, KJ? Right? You're going to suffer, right?
And that's the fact. Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, so we, and it's the hardest thing to honestly, I'll be, you know, frank with you guys. It's the hardest thing to get right is that accountability piece. But that's the key is like, if you could do that, all of a sudden you start to realize that relationships and accountability go hand in hand. And then we, you know, at the end of the day, there's a scoreboard. We're trying to, you know, they're keeping track of what's going on. You know, you're trying to win and lose. When you leave Tufts basketball, like that's going to be the same thing as you get into business, you know, relationships, whatever it is. You know, the winning and losing element doesn't go. So we embrace competing, but we try to make sure that competing is rooted in relationships and accountability. You know, we don't compete for the sake of it being cutthroat to try and cut each other down. Like we compete like a family would compete. Like if you have a brother or a sibling, the same way that you would compete with them and try and kick their butt, literally kick their butt. But afterwards, you're able to love on each other and joke.
Yeah.
Those are probably your most competitive moments, right? Or with your brother. So we want to have competitiveness, but rooted in something that's, relationship oriented. So if you're at the top of your game, KJ, Ruda, he's going to be, up in his game and vice versa. And if you add that, we feel if you have those three, key elements, you're bound to have a good environment. Now, winning and losing, you can't control that all the time, but that environment should stay consistently where it needs to be if you have those things.
Yeah, I mean, Coach, that's super tough. I like it. You said it's the rack, right? That's what you call it, the rack. Ruda and I, like one of our earlier episodes, we talked with the Hampton Sydney coach, and he told us his program's SOE, Standard of Excellence. So that's something that we live by, SOE, but the rack definitely got to go up there too, relationships, accountability, and competitiveness.
You got to add that to the notebook, KJ. You got to add
facts.
It.
It's getting added for sure. But so I mentioned how you guys had a really good year this year. You guys at large bid, only two losses in the NESCAC. Only two losses were to Trinity, National Championships, and Wesleyan, ranked number one through most of the year. So really good year. But I'm curious. So you guys made it to the tournament, won the first round. And then the Redlands game, midway through the second quarter, you guys were up like 16 points, but you ended up taking a tough loss in overtime. So I'm just like, I know how some coaches think, like when you take that tough loss, it's the only thing that's in your brain the whole offseason. Like, what could I have done better? What happened here? So I'm just curious, like, what were your takeaways from the tournament and that tough game against Redlands?
Yeah, man, bad coaching. Like you said, man, it's a bittersweet year because it's like, it's such a great year. You know, we did things that, quite frankly, haven't been done at Tufts, before. You know, it's the first time a Tufts team has won 20 games, three consecutive seasons. You know, first time a Tufts team has made it to three consecutive NCAA tournaments. First time a Tufts team has ever won 20 games in just the regular season before playoffs or anything like that. So it's like you had all these great things happen. But then it's like it makes the fall or like not, advancing all the way or not winning an NESCAC championship or, get into a Sweet 16 Elite Eight. It makes it feel that much more deflating. But it's, it's interesting, man. You got to start where credit's due, man. It's to Redlands. They play a style, that ultimately, led to us losing and them winning. I think, we did a good job, obviously, of, taking care of the basketball for the most part, especially first half and even second half. Like, you're just bound to, like, turn it over against a team that plays that discipline within that kind of style. But I think where you saw us get worn down more was kind of in the mental. And we stopped kind of doing some of the things that we normally do in every other game. We got out rebounded, which never happens. Some of the shots that, I think we, normally generate, we weren't able to. So execution, the mental side of that kind of suffered. But then there's also stuff that, I watch and it's just like, man, I wish I could have that back. I wish I could have that decision back. So, it's a total effect and, it sucks. We'll learn from it, but Redlands played phenomenal to put themselves in that spot, and you never like to see the team that beat you advance. But it wasn't a surprise that they made it to an Elite Eight with a chance to go to a Final Four. They're a talented team, got a great coach. So, but it definitely stings, man. And I think hopefully, you got to look into the future a little bit. But it could be one of those things where, this time next year, we're sitting here saying, that was the impetus that we needed to set us on track for the best year ever at Tufts. Or it could be something that, if you don't learn from it, it's just like another thing in a string of, unfortunate endings. So we're hoping it's the, the thing that propels us for next year. I know guys have been attacking this spring. The returns have been attacking the spring with that in mind, with their lifts. And pick up six. So it's, that's what it is.
definitely, you know, definitely expecting a great year out of you guys next year, Coach. I know you said like either of those two things can happen, but, you know, I feel like you guys are going to respond the right way. You guys have a lot of, you know, good players coming back, like James. How do you say his last name?
Morakis.
He's yeah. And he's really tough. I'm pretty sure he has another year left, and my boy Josh too. So you guys are, and I know you talked highly about some of the recruits that are coming in as well. So definitely expecting a great year out of Tufts, Coach. And I want to talk a little bit more about this recruiting aspect of it, because I want to know, like, you're working at Tufts, right? And when you're working at NESCAC school, it's a top of the top academic schools. And really, like, you can get kids from all across the country. Like, when you were naming some of the players, like, you said you had some guys from Florida or Philly or New Jersey. I know Josh is from Miami, or, you know, it says that James is from Dallas, right? So how do you, what type of player are you really looking for when you're recruiting one? But how do you use, like, the advantages of a NESCAC tool and advantages of a NESCAC school in recruiting? Excuse me.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, more than anything, you know, we're fortunate that, you know, Tufts is a national, you know, brand, a national university that, you know, allows us to kind of recruit nationally. You know, we get a lot of interest from kids regardless of where they're from. So because of that, you know, we really try and put a lot of onus and attention on, you know, making sure that we're trying to do a good job of not only evaluating talent, but you know, evaluating people and making sure that, you know, it's a twofold element, right? We're getting obviously great basketball players, but again, guys that are going to come in and contribute to the rack. So it's you know, it's definitely a daunting task, but it's also, you know, easy as you go through it. And I think we're also sitting in a fortunate spot where, you know, the talent pool that we're looking at, you know, we're looking at all guys that are either high end D3 talents, you know, or, you know, might be D2, D1 caliber guys. So the talent part usually isn't the thing that's hard. It's, yeah, it's finding the right guys, the right fit, the people with the right kind of drive and makeup to try and do something special. Like, that's the part that's hard. And quite frankly, you know, who you're saying no to, right? Because there might be some really, you can't take everybody. And obviously, you know, basketball is not like football where you could have, you know, 20 guys, 30 guys in the class. You got to make sure you hit on the, you know, 3 to 5 guys that you bring in. So we spend a lot of time trying to, you know, make sure that we're trying to get that right.
Yeah, I hear a lot about, like, so when these NESCAC schools are going out and recruiting, right, they may have like a little bit more of an advantage just because of the academics, right? Like, they can get some of the guys who are trying to go Patriot League D1 or, you know, a high academic, you know, D1 conference that maybe they couldn't get that offer. They'll come to a NESCAC school and play high level basketball, but also get a high level degree. So it's definitely, you know, great opportunity and advantages, you know, coaching at a NESCAC school.
No, absolutely, absolutely, and yeah, the academic piece of it, you know, is a big part, right? Shoot, there's probably a lot, you know, a lot more talented guys that, you know, could be playing at Tufts that we'd love to have at Tufts, that, you know, unfortunately with the admissions process, you know, we can't, you know, we can't recruit everybody, so it kind of, you know, it eliminates maybe half of the pool of talented guys that are out there. So, you know, on one end, you know, it's give or take, right? You can look at that as like, oh man, I wish you could recruit whoever. But on the other end, yeah, I guess it's an advantage to know that you have a, you know, a more kind of direct talent pool of what you're working with. So that kind of makes it easier to decide. And then from there, yeah, now you're fighting against the Amherst's, the Trinity's, you know, the Yale's, the Browns, like everybody trying to get the same product, good high academic guys. But it's all fun in the end.
I mean, the thing is, you've shown you could do it anywhere, though, because you did it at Nicholls, too, right? Like, Nicholls is kind of a completely different, like, academic environment, right? Like, I'm pretty sure low 80s in terms of acceptance rate. So they kind of let in, you know, more, obviously let in more people. And you won the conference championship your first season at Nicholls, which is a big accomplishment. It's a great league, Coastal Commonwealth Conference, right? You guys played Nicholls in the conference championship game. I remember watching that game. You know, I'm pretty sure, like, I'm really close with Billy Arsenault, who's a great player for Endicott. But I remember just Nicholls having a crazy run. And fortunately, it was the COVID year, so it kind of ended the NCAA tournament. But just talk about your experience, you know, coaching at Nicholls, your memories from that amazing year, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was lucky to, you know, come into to Nichols and inherit, quite frankly, just like a loaded loaded team. So they were coming off of, you know, their best year ever. You know, they had won three in a row, you know, went to the Elite Eight, 28-3, and they graduated Marcos Echevarria, who was like probably, I think he still is, an all-time leading scorer.
Yeah, he is.
He was on staff with me as a grad assistant, and I'm thankful I had him my first year there because he was able to put me on game, you know, right away as to, you know, how to keep Nichols rolling, you know, the do's and don'ts, this guy, what he likes, what he doesn't like. But losing Coast was, you know, absolutely, it's like, all right, that's going to be a big deal. But we still had pretty much the entire team intact. I still remember, man, first game at Nichols, we were playing at WPI in like a little opening season tournament against Eastern Connecticut State. And we had two big guys, two phenomenal big guys, Matt Morrow, Jerome Cunningham, who were, you know, preseason All-Americans. And Jerome, our athletic 6'8", big dude, literally 30 seconds into the first game, tore his ACL on a putback opportunity. And I'm 30 seconds into my coaching career, head coaching career, with this team with high aspirations, and you're just like, what the heck? Like, it just, you know, just, it kind of all just felt like time stood still as, you know, you're watching Jerome out there on the ground. But it was kind of crazy, you know, everything from that point, you know, and honestly, it kind of made everything real. And it was kind of my first lesson into, you know, head coaching. You know, you cannot prepare for literally what's gonna take place, right? So you got to have the ability to adapt on the fly. Development is key. Trust is key. You know, we're able to kind of navigate, you know, losing such a key piece and still have a great year, you know, just because of, you know, the ability to kind of rally around each other and the development that we, you know, kind of poured into those guys. But it was fun, man. Like Deontay Bruton, you know, was our leading scorer and guy that year. He is, you know, it's almost unfair to sit here and take any credit for what we did that year because honestly, Deontay, man, we just kind of rode and followed on onto him, man. He was so special. He's such a joy to coach. He made it easy. We had a lot of games that we probably should have, you know, lost that, you know, he kind of turned around for us. And, you know, he had an unbelievable playoff run that year where he pretty much single-handedly, you know, kicked the butt of the three teams on a championship there. But it was fun. That was honestly one of my, you know, fondest memories, man, is that year, that season with those guys winning that chip. You know, playing in the NCAA tournament, it was a blast, man. So I really enjoyed it.
So you said that Echevarria was on your GA for your first year at Nichols, right?
Oh yeah.
So his brother went to Endicott, and he was a really good player for them. So how was that like scouting process, like brother brother? I'm kind of wondering about that.
Yeah, Jalen always talks smack, man. He always come up and lay up lines. We talking smack to his brother, talking smack to me. Game would start. You know, that's what the Echevarrias do, man. But it was funny. Like Marcos was definitely you know, the big brother. He'd be like, "You got to do this. You got to make sure you get him this way." So we were able to, you know, he still had good games against us his freshman year, but Coach. He wanted to beat his brother's butt, man. That's for sure.
So you guys got the dub. So yep, you always say
I know a few people are going to be listening from the CCC during that time, and you said that Marcos was like putting you on game on how to like kind of get that four piece. So what were some of the things you got to do to be dominant in the CCC back then?
Honestly, we had good players still, man. It was cool. That was obviously Deontay. You know, had a phenomenal senior season. We lost Jerome, which was, you know, real tough. But we had multiple step up. Matt Moore, the big guy on that team, really just became a force down for us. Jaquan Spencer, he kind of emerged. So Jaquan, it was funny. If anything, Coach, that was a lot of the game that he put me onto was like how to get the most out of Jaquan, because he was a talented freshman the year before on that Elite 8 team. But, you know, he was kind of in and out of the rotation as most, you know, freshmen, talented freshmen on talented teams are. But as a sophomore that year, especially with Jerome going down, losing Coast to graduation, Jaquan stepped up and, you know, he really became, he burst onto the scene that year as a sophomore. And then he had a really good career after I left. But he helped, you know, with the development of him. And then we just had, you know, some other just really great seniors and you know, role guys that also stepped in and filled up in big ways. But it's funny, man, Nicholas is a special place, man. Those dudes, they were winning at a high level well before I got there and especially after. And, you know, it's just, again, being a first-time head coach, you know, it's a lot of stuff that you overthink. Marcos was just really good at being like, man, coach, like, cut the BS, man. This is what, just get to the point. Let's just do this. We don't need to do this drill. Let's just compete. You know, he was, he helped me keep things simple. You know, when I tried to, you know, maybe be a new coach who's trying out all new types of stuff, it was just, he was good that way, man. So I always appreciate Marcos for that.
Yeah, shout out to all the Nichols guys, special memories, but stay with us while we take a quick break. We are back with Coach Linton on the Not Even D2 pod. So you won a CCC at Nichols. Then the year following was the COVID year. And following year after that, you got hired as the Tufts head coach. And I was talking to a few coaches like last week, and they were saying how like arguably the Tufts job is like the best Division III head coaching job in the country. So that's obviously big time. I'm curious kind of how that fell into your lap. Like, talk about how that opportunity came to you.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder who said that. They're right, man. It's I push myself every day. Like, I'm lucky to work at Tufts. It's the best of a lot of different worlds, man. But yeah, it was Coach Sheldon was the longtime head coach at Tufts, and it was funny. We actually played. We played against Tufts that same year in 1920 when we won the CCC, went to the tournament. We played that Tufts team and lost to them, and they went on to win the first ever NESCAC championship that year. And then they won their first two games in the NCAA tournament, and then everything shut down. But in the middle of COVID, Coach Sheldon decided to retire, which obviously, you know, opened up the opportunity. So they had an interim in place, and then when the process opened up, I was fortunate to be one of the people that got in the mix. The women's coach here actually played college basketball with my wife at Bowdoin College. So, you know, I didn't know her too well, but, you know, I kind of just floated my interest. And luckily she passed that along and, you know, I made it onto the candidate list. And then from there, you know, the rest is history, as I say, you know, kind of went through the Zooms and the in-person interviews and all that stuff. And, you know, just really hit it off with John Morris, the AD, and you know, was you know, fortunate to be extended an offer, and you know, didn't hesitate.
Nah, I mean, that's a crazy story, Coach. How was can you kind of walk me through? Because, you know, like I've told you, like, I'm aspiring coach. I think KJ and I both are, you know, potentially aspiring coaches. So how did that process go for you? What was your headspace like when you were trying to, like, you know, make those connections? Let's talk about that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I think it's you know, it's always surreal, you know, once you get into it. You know, I think again, I kind of mentioned that in imposter syndrome, you know, that I have, especially, you know, I think as a Black coach, you know, I think you always, you know, probably tell yourself things that you probably aren't meant for or can't get, or they probably never hire me. So to even, you know, be in that space, you know, was surreal in and of itself. You know, I think it was balancing a lot of different emotions, man. Like, obviously, you know, Nichols was a special place, but, you know, I think, the NESCAC was always something that, you know, I had in my, my vision, working at Bowdoin College from 2012 to 14, you know, just getting a taste of the league. I knew, you know, if I could ever, you know, be a head coach at one of these schools, that would just align with, you know, everything that I value in terms of being at a high academic place and all that stuff. So, so it was everything, man. It was a little bit of anxiousness, excitement, you know, just trying to do everything that you can to, you know, hopefully put yourself in the right light, you know, talking to as many people that might be connected to the situation to see if that, you know, could help in any way. You know, it was crazy. It was also along the same timeline that the Bowdoin College job was open. And I was also in the mix for that opportunity as well. So it was a cool, it was a stressful time kind of like navigating all that. And I was fortunate enough to get offered both opportunities and, you know, ended up choosing Tufts. And again, I just mentioned, you know, my wife played basketball at Bowdoin. So, you know, that was, you know, always a place that we thought that we could end up back at because of, you know, the prior connection with me working there, you know, her playing there. So it was kind of a whirlwind of a period, you know, deciding between the two spots, even being considered for either spot was crazy to me. But at the end of the day, the choice was simple, man, to be at a place like Tufts and call this place home.
Yeah, like Tufts is definitely, like we already talked about, academic side of it, but even the facilities too, like, you know, like we talked about and, you know, off air, I've been to the Tufts gym, you know, playing pickup and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't always have my best shooting day, you know, playing pickup at Tufts, but I always admired the gym though. Always loved
it. It's cool. Yeah, it's unique. It's different. It's got the old school staircase in it. Everyone always talks about the staircase.
We had Chosen Amadi on the pod, and he was talking about how, like, your guys' fans go crazy, too.
He's probably still looking for some of them to scrap with, man. They were going back and forth. The next guy, all the crowds, that's what's fun about the league, man. It's, you know, the kids, it's all sports teams. They all come out and support their buddies and their friends and all that stuff. But, yeah, it's a fun atmosphere, especially those playoff games.
Definitely, you know, watching those games, you could hear the crowd through the screen, obviously. And like I was saying, just the atmosphere in the Tufts gym. I mean, it looks like on the outside, maybe a little bit older, but you come on the inside and it still is kind of like an older feel, but it's like, it's still like, it's fresh. It's, you know, that you have the crowd can sit above, right, and like watch the game that's happening below. So it's definitely a cool, interesting vibe. And, you know, you mentioned that you coached at Bowdoin. Before, and you also coached at Army and Nichols. And I'm wondering how these experiences at these different programs kind of influenced you in your first year at Tufts.
Yeah, no, it was that's a great question. You know, I think obviously going to Clarkson, working there for 2 years, I was fortunate. I've always been fortunate, man, to just be the beneficiary of great people. And I think, you know, that led to, you know, that relationships, you know, value in the rack, you know. You know, I'm a byproduct of great people and great relationships. And, you know, it really started with Mark Gilbride, who's now the head coach at RPI. He came in my senior year and took over and, you know, was the head coach at Clarkson my last year. And, you know, it's funny, man, I always, you know, even at Nichols and then when I got here to Tufts, I always come back to being a senior during, you know, Coach Gilbride's first year as a head coach. And I tell him all the time, man, I'm just like, I apologize over and over because I'm like, man, I must have been such an asshole to be, you know, the coach of, you know, because as seniors in college, especially with a new coach, you always think you know it all and somebody new is coming in and they want to change everything. And you know, I definitely was probably super headstrong and wasn't easy to deal with. So it's kind of funny how I took those lessons as I, you know, embarked on a first year at a Nichols, at a Tufts. But Mark was the best, you know. After I graduated, he brought me back as a, you know, volunteer assistant coach, and I worked in the admissions office at Clarkson, and did that for 2 years. And then when his dad at Bowdoin had an opening, he said, "Hey, you know, if you really want to get into coaching and stay in it, you know, he's got a full-time assistant opening. I think you should go for it." And again, you know, rest was history with that. You know, I interviewed, got it. And I worked at Bowdoin for 2 years with Tim Gilbride. And again, working with the Gilbrides, you know, I'm just eternally grateful for them, man, just the best people. But that set me on the path that I eventually am now on. Working at, you know, Clarkson's a good academic school. Bowdoin was a high academic school. that led me to, you know, get into the Patriot League at Army for 5 years, another high academic school. I knew I wanted to be a head coach. You know, Nichols opened up, obviously, great basketball, good academics. But I knew I wanted to get back to that high academic space. So all of it kind of helped lead to, you know, wanting to be in an environment like a Tufts and NESCAC. And again, you know, I kind of mentioned, you know, thinking about me as a senior, you know, with a new coach, and you know, I tried to, you know, coach in a way that, was always, you know, thinking of the seniors in mind, most importantly, you know, when taking over at Nichols and taking over at Tufts, and just trying to do everything we could to, you know, make sure that year didn't feel too disruptive, you know, for those guys. And I think, you know, that's one thing, I feel like I learned taking over at, you know, two different spots is, you know, first and foremost, it's not easy. It's probably, I would argue, harder to take over, you know, teams that had success the year prior and to try and keep it going than it is to take over a team that is coming off an 0-25 year, because anything is progress. But the one thing I tried to do, and, you know, who knows if it was good or worked or whatnot, but just tried to put seniors first and, you know, include them in the conversations and how things were going and how they wanted things to go. And not saying that Mark didn't do that, but I just know how important that relationship is to get right on that first year.
Yeah, no, I respect that 100%. Shout out to Coach Gilbride. I've talked to a few coaches, and everybody who's worked under him always has high praises for, you know, like his influence on their coaching career. So definitely shout out to him. But so I was talking to Coach Ed Silva, coach at UNE, and he was talking to me about how you're a great guy. You run a great program at Nichols and now at Tufts. But he mentioned to me that you were very passionate about equity, inclusion, and leadership at Nichols. And I'm kind of curious how, like, Tufts is a PWI, and you mentioned, like, how as a Black coach already, you're second-guessing yourself. So how are you kind of bringing those aspects of coaching into the Tufts program?
Yeah, no, great question, man. I'm glad Ed shared that. You know, it was cool. You know, it was, you know, when I was at Nichols, it was in the height of COVID and the pandemic and obviously all the social unrest, you know, after George Floyd was murdered. So, you know, as hard as that was, you know, there were some good things that came out of it, one of which being, you know, the we were able to start up a group, a social justice group at Nichols that, you know, I got to be kind of the point person on from, you know, coaching the athletic department standpoint. We had a bunch of student athletes who were super passionate, and it was cool just to kind of be somebody to help, you know, serve as a support unit for them, but also to help kind of push different initiatives and programming that that was important to us. And then, you know, obviously getting here, the Tufts, like you said, at a PWI, and, you know, obviously the team when I first came in was very reflective of the, you know, entire school in terms of, you know, the demographics. Again, not that any of that is bad. It's just interesting, right? And, you know, I think I felt like I had a unique opportunity to, you know, just carry out some of the ideas that I've always held true to myself, which, you know, every team or group doesn't have to necessarily be the same. It doesn't matter what it is, but I think perspective is key in, you know, all of this. I think with more perspective, you have greater, you know, empathy. So, you know, we've just tried to honestly build a team that, you know, I kind of feel like embodies what I kind of grew up around being from Queens. You know, we had people from all different types of, you know, walks of life when I was, you know, growing up you know, just trying to, you know, build a team that's inclusive of everything, not only just race, but hopefully geography, socioeconomic status, you know, you name it, you know, just a group that everyone could feel that they're benefiting from being a part of. And, you know, not intentionally just trying to slant it one way or the other, but, you know, just trying to have an environment that's, you know, representative. And then, you know, honestly, you know, We have a DEI committee here at Tufts that I'm a part of, which has been awesome. You know, it's been a good driver of conversations and initiatives. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, quite frankly, we still need to continue doing. But it's been great to be at a place like Tufts that's open and receptive to, you know, still trying to be inclusive, even though that's something that's being used as like a curse word, you know, as we kind of navigate the world today. You know, Tufts has been great about, you know, standing on business when it comes to inclusivity. So that's been refreshing. That's been that's almost doubled down my my pride in being a jumbo and being here at Tufts. So so it's cool. We're in a good place. You know, I think the school in general is a great place in that regard. Our team, obviously, we, you know, it's not like we do programming. I'll be honest. You know, somebody asked me this. I forget who it was, but it's not like we're sitting down and having like, you know, programming sessions on this stuff. My big thing is just trying to make sure that the vibe is one that, you know, again, inclusive and, you know, people feel open to be able to be who they are, you know, whatever that is. You know, allowing a space for, you know, people to feel empowered to like speak up about what's on their mind or what's important to them. And I feel like we've done that. I feel like it's also something that you probably never really know if you're hitting the mark on. But, you know, I'm a big vibes guy, and we're trying to keep the vibes as such that it feels inclusive and people understand, like, you know, the do's and don'ts of, you know, of an environment.
I just want to say, Coach, definitely love that you're, you know, taking on that responsibility, like, head on, right? Like, you know, I have this opportunity as the coach at Tufts to create an inclusive environment that, you know, is representative of where I grew up, right? And that's awesome. Like, I grew up in, like we were talking about early on in the episode, like, I grew up in Brooklyn, Crown Heights, right? Which is a super, like, Caribbean community. And then I went to school in Lower East Side where, you know, I had went to school with people from all walks of life, right? And you always, and it's interesting you're talking about how inclusivity is seen as like a curse word now, and really that's how life kind of is. You're supposed to be inclusive, right? You're supposed to.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, that's should be what this country was founded on, right? Like, everybody being created equal. So it's nothing that's, you know, different. I mean, it's something that people will try and make you feel like is taboo and different, but it's not. And, you know, I think we're all better because of obviously all of our differences. You know, I think we all can agree on that one. It was funny, like, one of the more fun things that we did, or cool things that I reflect on, is with Josh. Like, we went, you know, Tufts has, you know, a lot of case on camp, and they invited for kosher dinner, and it was cool. And obviously for Josh as a Jewish kid, for our whole team to pull up to halal and, you know, eat and break bread with the other Jewish kids on campus, like, that was really cool. So, like, we don't, you know, again, I don't share that to, you know, get a pat on the back, but I'm more so just saying, like, those kind of things, like, it doesn't matter, you know, what the deal is, to do something that's outside of, you know, your norm, so to speak, and just gain a deeper, I don't know, respect and perspective on something that's different from what you are used to. I don't see how that's a bad thing.
Definitely not a bad thing at all, Coach. And, you know, you provided a lot of great insights for us, you know, during this episode. We really appreciate the conversation. But now we're going to get into rapid fire, and KJ got starting five after rapid fire. But you ready for rapid fire or no?
Is anybody ever truly ready for rapid fire? We'll see how it goes, man. I'm gonna take it out of homes.
I got three questions for you, Coach. So, first rapid fire question: do you have like a dream, like, coaching matchup in the NBA or like high major college basketball? And if so, who is it?
Oh man, shoot! Right now it might be Tom Thibodeau, man. I'm pissed at him. I want to. Coach him for his job, man.
Night.
I would say a dream matchup. Honestly, I don't know. I just always grew up, you know, as obviously a huge Knicks fan, and like the Jeff Van Gundy era was probably more my, you know, my era as a kid, kind of coming up in those Knicks teams in the late '90s, early 2000s, and like I've always just admired. Jeff Van Gundy, obviously he was a D3 Hooper, upstate New York guy.
Facts.
So, you know, if you know, to go up against him, that'd be pretty cool.
Like that pick a lot. Next rapid fire question we got for you. So you grew up in Queens, like you talked about, right? And I'm just wondering what kind of music taste you're into, because Queens and like Brooklyn as a whole has a lot of legendary rappers. And like, I'm like, my dad was a big Nas and Jay-Z fan, so that, you know, brushed off on me. So I'm wondering like what you're into.
Yeah, no, great question, man. If John Medley on our team, he'd be mad at me because I'm not listening to all the drill stuff that he's on now. But no, it's funny, like, you know, J. Cole, like...
that boy.
It's funny. So J. Cole, his right-hand man with Dreamville, the guy Ibrahim, he played high school ball at Holy Cross, where I went to high school.
Mm-hmm.
So Ibe was a couple years older. He had probably just graduated Holy Cross as I was coming in. But we would always, you know, it's a community deal. So we'd always see each other at the games. He'd always come back for... we always run like a kids camp at our high school, and he'd always come back as an alum. I'd be there as a current player. But long story short, like going into, I think my senior year, or I might've been actually going into college. So it might've been senior summer, before my freshman year going to Clarkson, he came back to camp and he had a trunk full of like these mixtapes from his boy at St. John's. And, he was giving them out to everybody, and we're like,
Ain't nobody want this.
Yeah, growing up in Queens, like everybody has a mixtape. Everybody's putting their. It was funny. It was after my freshman year at Clarkson, because I had my car, and I remember he gave me the CD, and I was driving a couple kids home from camp, and we were bumping it, and it was J. Cole's. I'm blanking on which mixtape it was. It was one of his first mixtapes. And I remember just like putting it on, and that's back when CDs were big. I remember putting it in the tray and just being like, this is different. This is a completely different sound. And from there, like I went back to Clarkson. I was just like, J. Cole is that guy. He's that guy. He's that guy. And like that's when Drake was just starting up, and it was always Drake versus J. Cole. So I've always been like a J. Cole guy, but you know, any of the, you know, kind of more deeper rap, lyrical rap, I think that's kind of more my speed. I used to be able to say I'm a big Kanye guy, but now that's kind of been canceled now. But Kanye was big. Obviously Jay-Z, even as a Queens guy, I could big up Jay. But Cole is definitely the guy that I feel most connected to.
That's definitely a great pull for you, Coach. I'm not gonna lie. And then last rapid fire question. What is your favorite gym to play in besides, how do you pronounce the Tufts gym?
Cousins, yeah.
Cousins. Cousins. So what is your favorite gym to play in besides Cousins?
Ooh, at the D3 level?
Yeah, let's do D3, and then if you have one from D1, we could do that too.
All right, at the D3 level, man, this is tough. Favorite one to play in? It's kind of funny, and this might be biased because I worked there for 2 years, but Bowdoin was always like it's kind of like a unique little gym, but I always like that. Bates, actually, I might give some shout outs to Bates. Like Bates has got the oldest gym, I think, in America, but like they always seem to, you know, it always feels like it's like a million people in there, and it's super loud. It's always a close game when you play there. So that, you know, it just, you always know it's going to feel like a dope atmosphere playing that bait. So that might be one of them. But that's a good rapid fire question, man, because I don't know. I think about that. Two main schools for you, I'll give you.
That's tough. Great gyms. We got to move to the starting five edition. So if you're a coach assembling a lineup, point guard through center, who's your lineup going to be? And this edition is the best players that you've coached. So just tell me their names and where you coach them at. And what position they're going to be playing in your lineup?
Yeah. That's a good one. So for this, I'll exclude current players. I don't want to make anybody jealous. You know, the former guys, I would say Deontay Bruton has to be. He's probably on that list. So he's going to be in the guard spot, whether he's shooting guard or point guard. We're going to wait and see. Actually, he'll be shooting guard. Point guard will be Tommy Funk. So he was at Army when I was there.
Okay.
So he was like Mr. Everything at the point guard spot for Army. He was a dog. He was from Philly. You know, he played on the same team as Colin Gillespie, who went to Villanova. Mm-hmm. Tommy was a certain point guard. You know what I mean? Like, that level of dog. But that's my backcourt. We're going to be a little small, but we're feisty. We got a bunch of buckets, both for lefties. At the small forward, I might have to go with Dylan Thorner. When I was here at Tufts, I coached him for 2 years. He was a bucket. He was as good of a guy that I've coached. He went on to actually do a grad year at UC Irvine and was a bucket. Mm. We got some shooting and some size there. Could go a lot of ways with the other forward spot, man. But I'll go with Jaquan again. Jaquan, so him and Dylan, they could interchange. We could play a little small ball, be dynamic. But Jaquan, I put him at the four. But he, obviously, I coached him at Nichols. He was a unique blend, man. He was like 6'6", 6'7", could dunk on you, shoot the three, handle it, lock up.
It's tough.
I put Quan in there. And then a lot of good candidates for big guy, but I'll actually give a sneaky pick to my guy, John Swords. He was a 7-footer at Bowdoin when I was there back in the day. And he literally couldn't be stopped. Like he was a dude who his first 2 years, like he couldn't walk and tie his shoes at the same time. Whatever the saying is, by the time his junior year came, like it just clicked for him. And literally he would just be at the rim and dunking on dudes, blocking shots. He had great hands and feet. He was almost like Bill Walton, like literally on court and off. He was kind of like unique, and he would read books in the locker room. He wouldn't do layup line. He would just read books in the locker room before games. Kind of an eccentric personality, but he was a force. So that's going to be my five.
That's a great lineup, Coach. Definitely coach really good players. That lineup definitely do some damage, but that's going to do it for another episode of Not Even D2. We appreciate you getting on and hoping the best for Coach Lynn.
Absolutely. Appreciate you guys having me, man. Love everything that you guys are doing. Keep up the good work. And thank you for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2.
Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter. That's the best way to support the channel.
And all episodes released on iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's going to do it. And we'll see you next week on Thursday.
Yo, bro, that was a fire episode.
OD.